This is the 11kVW Employment Podcast, where every month members of our employment team get together to chat about a recent case. But this isn't any usual month, because this month it's Silks Month. And I'm Ruth Kennedy, and today I'm joined by three new Silks, new employment Silks in Chambers. Simon Forshaw.
Hi Ruth, very nice to see you.
Judy Stone.
Hello.
And Amy Rogers.
Yeah, hi Ruth, great to be here.
I'm going to be speaking to each of them about one of the cases they worked on in their last year as a junior. So shall we kick off by talking about what is taking silk? When we talk about that, what do we mean?
Oh, it's the gown. So silk is the silk's gown. One of many things that happen as you go over the transition is you have to get rid of your junior's gown and get a new gown, which is quite literally silk.
And what happens on Silk's Day?
Well, lots of things. I mean, excitingly, we get picked up from Chambers, having got into our gear, first of all, and come down to all our waiting family and friends to see us in our lovely outfits. We then get photographed. We get taken in fancy cars to the Houses of Parliament, where we are presented with, what is it we're presented with?
It's a letters patent,
is it? Right, yes, by the Lord Chancellor. And then we come back to Chambers for a quick lunch before going over to take part in a bowing ceremony in the court of the Lady Chief Justice, followed by, as I understand it, various other bowing ceremonies around the Royal Courts estate.
I feel like you glossed over the dressing up aspect of this somewhat there, Simon, because this has involved procuring a pretty bizarre selection of clothing, even by our standards. We've had to get shoes with special buckles or discover other people in Chambers who have taken silk previously, have got the same size feet as you do. We have to have gloves, that white gloves that you don't even wear. There was a ruffle situation that, I mean, do you know how to put that on?
I don't, but do we not wear the gloves? Do we just carry the gloves?
We just carry the gloves because they weren't sized. So that's how I know that. And I think what else is there?
There's a black rosette, which is mourning for Charles II or somebody.
Didn't you
who
say
died
it was
a very long
Queen
time
Anne?
Ago?
I think the colour of the gown is because the bar has been in mourning for Queen Anne since her passing 300 years ago.
We have long memories.
I can't pretend to be an expert.
We are a modern and forward-thinking profession and never let anyone say anything else.
Particularly with the full-bottomed wigs, I think that really gives me 2024 vibes.
Yeah, but you're missing Simon's breeches. I mean, Simon, you're going to have the full kit.
I was told by somebody who I won't disclose their name, but the rather than wearing the tights, I should buy myself a pair of pop socks from Dorothy Perkins, because apparently they're far more comfortable than the tights that Eden Rose
costs. You need to disclose your source for that.
I can't possibly do that.
You're not Silks yet, but when this episode comes out, you will be.
Well, steady on. That depends on us bowing to the right people and not falling flat on our feet as we walk down Westminster Hall. But subject to that.
Subject to that. When did you know? When did you find out that you were going to be silkified?
Oh, I can do this one. It was at 9:02 a.m. on the 19th of January.
Very vivid memory.
Exactly the day before the public finds out. So you get 24 hours to control your own emotions before it very much does go public.
Do you find it hard keeping it a secret?
You're allowed to tell family and friends immediately, but not to sort of put it on Facebook or whatever. So, it wasn't too difficult to keep it secret more generally for 24 hours.
And we knew that all four of us had succeeded, so it was lovely. We had a day where we could celebrate together and really sort of sit back and reflect on what had happened, what was about to happen, and what the future would hold.
And that we never have to do that form again.
Most importantly.
Amy, did you always want to be an employment barrister?
I didn't want to be a barrister at all. I wanted to be a speechwriter. But then once I decided to go into the law, actually, I started by wanting to be a public lawyer and dealing with judicial review claims. And our senior clerk at the time, the wonderful Philip Monham, arrived in my room one day and said, I think you should try some employment trials. I think you might enjoy them. And that was shortly before I was instructed in the Tullett and BGC litigation, which then ran for months and months and was a massive High Court trial. And I loved it. And that was that settled. From then on, I was an employment lawyer.
What about you, Simon? always
No, I didn't want to be a lawyer either. I mean, when I was a child, I wanted to be a musician. And the only thing that held me back was any sort of musical talent. But once I had decided that I was going to become a lawyer, yes, I did want to be an employment lawyer. I studied employment law at Oxford under Mark Friedland, and he was utterly inspirational. So from that moment, I decided, yes, I wanted to practice in employment law.
You, Judy?
I think my chosen careers progressed from wanting to be a gymnast to wanting to be a philosophy professor to working for the UN and then also wanting to be a public lawyer like Amy, which is why I came to these chambers, I think, was really to work in public law. But as one of our colleagues always says, employment law is like Hello Magazine for geeks because it has got loads of great stories. It's really about the people, but there's also loads of interesting law to work with. And also, the people who work in this field are just lovely. My opponents are lovely, my clients are lovely, and my colleagues are lovely. And I think that's really a big part of the draw.
What about you, Ruth? Did you always want to be an employment barrister?
I had a previous kind of profession in sheep judging, which is always what I wanted to monetize but failed to do so.
I have literally no idea what that means.
Well, I'm glad you asked, Judy, because in my youth, I was a... I don't want to say pro, but I was a bit of a pro sheep judger, which involves judging sheep and then having a professional judge the sheep that you have judged to see how close it is to a professional's judgment of the sheep.
The things you don't know about your colleagues.
Yeah. So turning then to the cases that you've been working on for the last year as a senior junior before making that transition. And if I look at you first, Amy, because you're going to talk about Guy Carpenter versus Howden, which we spent many hours working on together, many joyous hours working on together. So what was that case about?
Oh, that was a team move case. So you and I were doing that together with a team of others. It was a really interesting team move case because it was cross-border, multi-jurisdictional. So a team of employees, as the claimant would have it, across multiple different countries across Europe, all left to move to a direct competitor. And having established jurisdiction in the English courts, the question was what relief should be granted, and then ultimately at an expedited trial, should the court make findings of unlawful means conspiracy and all of the various other claims being alleged, and what remedies should it grant at the end of it? But because it was an expedited trial, obviously all of this was happening in what was a matter of 4 or 5 months, really, before we reached a settlement, shortly before the trial was due to begin.
And why did you find this a particularly interesting case? You do a lot of team move cases. What was special about it?
For me, it was the cross-border feature of it. You know, looking at, we had issues under Italian law as well as English law, looking at how you approached restraint of trade issues across different jurisdictions, and just managing the process, the evidence, and getting ready for trial when dealing with witnesses across Europe and a business scattered across Europe.
And what are the particular challenges in that quick time frame? But it requires working very, very quickly and getting across things rapidly in comparison to other cases.
It does, but, and I may be in a minority of one here, I think that's what makes expedited trials so enjoyable. You've got a really short period, you've got to make decisions fast, you've got to make strategic calls fast, and then you've just got to keep going as you get through the months, get through the weeks until you get to a trial. And it's certainly intense and it's an enormous amount of work, but it's really rewarding because you see all of your strategic and tactical decisions pay off, you hope, in relatively short order.
So how do you stay sane during an expedited trial?
That's assuming she stays sane.
Yeah. Thank you, Judy. Stayed perfectly sane throughout. I mean, the truth is, and you know, Ruth, you know this as much as I do, it's the teams that make it. So we were really lucky on that case to have a fantastic supporting solicitor team who were absolutely across the material, but also were just a delight to work with. And we had a lovely team in chambers and in other chambers on our side. And nice opponents. So, you know, one of the lovely things I've always thought about the employment world and the employment bar certainly is you're dealing with lots of really talented, pleasant opponents who make cases fun to do.
And as you said, there were some of our opponents who were in these chambers. Is there anything in particular that's difficult or strange about that?
No, I mean, clients are sometimes taken aback when they realise that barristers can be on opposing sides within the same chambers. But the truth is, it's a real feature of specialist practice. It happens all the time. We've got systems to manage it, so that's business as usual.
I think we've all been against each other, haven't we, on various cases over the years?
Yeah, and well, within the last year, haven't we? Amy and I have certainly been against each other. I think
you've been continuing a case that I've had involvement with on the other side.
Yeah, and we've been against each other relatively recently, maybe not in the past 12 months, but...
We've had a couple of things, haven't
we? Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And it can get a bit awkward when everyone's trying to work out when we can have dinner, but we're all in cases against each other and everyone knows when the pleading deadlines are, so that can sometimes mean that it's harder to arrange.
Judy, tell us about the case that you're going to talk about today.
I'm going to talk about a case called Sparta, and I'm talking about this case because it's just so very current. In fact, there was a cost judgment out just yesterday. I'm also talking about it because, I was representing the individual, he's called Mr. Hayes, and there were Silks representing both my former employer, who was bringing the claim against my client, and also my new employer. So I was sitting around in the second row, because while you're a junior, you sit in the second row of the court, and the Silks sit in the front row, while waiting for this decision to come out, when everyone else who was speaking in this case was sitting in the front row. So I thought I quite liked this as a choice of as one of my last cases as a junior. So this is hopefully the last time I sit in that second row. So that's why I chose it. But that's, of course, not what the case is about at all. And that's far too much about me. So I was representing the individual, Mr. Hayes, and he worked for a company called Sparta in a field called hire, train and deploy. So what they do is they take people who have been out of work or are underrepresented in a field, train them up and then deploy them. He left his former employer to work for somebody new. And in the usual way of all these cases, his former employer, Sparta, brought a claim trying to prevent him from working for a competitor.
What was the key issue in this case?
I mean, it sort of depends what you're really interested in terms of the case, because there's not something for everyone. There's something for different people who are interested in covenants cases and post-termination restrictions. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting is the degree to which the merits were considered, even though we were at the interim stage. So the judge didn't just hold that there was a serious issue to be tried, which is the gateway test to that initial first relief, but also went on to look at the merits in a little bit more detail. And one of the merits points that the judge looked at was the extent to which my client, Mr. Hayes's relationship with his employer was a employment-type relationship where it would be subject to more scrutiny because there are restraints, as you know, on post-termination restrictions and what you can restrain, or if it was in an investment agreement, whether this was a more commercial arrangement where the courts would take a lighter touch.
What did you enjoy about this case?
I was listening to what Amy was saying about how much she enjoyed the fast-paced environment of the expedited trial. And while this case was on a much smaller and less global scale than the one that Amy was talking about, it really brought me that same joy of the fast-paced decision-making, working closely with my clients, with my solicitor clients, and with a lay client as well. And in some ways, there's a bit more of an instant gratification you get when you've got an injunction that plays out over a matter of weeks rather than a matter of months.
Really interesting what you were describing there, Judy, about the court having to grapple with an employment relationship, but also a shareholder relationship, and how you approach restraint of trade issues in those different contexts, but taking account of the factual reality. I mean, my sense is these issues are coming up more and more. Is that how you see the market?
I mean, I've seen this in almost every case because so many of these quite senior employees, and it's quite frankly often the senior employees who come to us, it's often senior employees with whom these cases are concerned. They often have both. So they'll have an employment contract and they'll also have an investment agreement. And it can be quite hard for an employer to try and justify what is often more extensive restraints in the investment agreement. And of course, often having to really grapple with the nature of the relationships in some detail.
So turning to you, Simon, you're going to speak about Holman, Fenwick, Willen and Samady. Tell us about that case.
Well, my case is an interesting case for all lawyers because it involves the question of what to do when your client doesn't pay you.
Very important.
Which we all have an interest in.
What was the key issue in that case?
Well, I think in order to explain the key issue, I probably just need to take a step back and explain the facts a little bit. And what had happened in that case is that the defendant had a series of companies. They'd racked up fees in various pieces of litigation with the lawyers. The bills hadn't been paid. Invoices had been issued, but not paid. And so in order to deal with the situation, the solicitors did what solicitors often do in that situation, which is entered into a compromise agreement whereby fees were payable on a payment schedule, in a discount for prompt payment, in essence, was the deal. But the interesting thing about this case was that the agreement to pay the fees was not with the companies who'd been involved in the litigation and therefore had racked up the fees, but with the mover and shaker behind the companies, the individual. And essentially, the solicitors wanted to fix that individual with liability for the fees. So the issue in the case became, well, there were two, really. First of all, was that individual liable under an indemnity, personal indemnity, or under a guarantee? And then secondly, could the individual use the provisions of the Solicitors Act to say, I can't be liable on this compromise agreement because I'm entitled to an assessment under the Solicitors Act? So those were the two key issues that the court had to grapple with.
And what were the answers to those questions?
Well, one answer, very clear, Mr. Justice Friedman came to the clear view that on the wording of the compromise agreement, that the individual had entered into a personal liability and it was an indemnity and not merely a guarantee on the bills. So the answer to that was very clear. The answer to the second question was whether or not the Solicitors Act could be used as an obstacle to enforcement of that agreement was clear in this case. It couldn't. The solicitors were entitled to summary judgment on their claim. But that threw up more complicated issues as to the position more generally. And it gives rise to quite interesting public policy issues, which is why I've chosen to speak about this case. So the public policy considerations are that the contracts that clients enter into with solicitors, the retainers that solicitors operate under, are different to normal contracts. A normal contractual situation, you enter into a contract and the individual has to discharge the terms of the contract. But the conduct of litigation or the provision of advice is different because it's about the administration of justice. And the court retains the ability to regulate that to a certain extent. So as a result of that, where a solicitor issues a client with a bill, a client has a right to be able to claim assessment in relation to that bill by the court. So the court can exercise its sort of supervisory or oversight function in relation to that. And the question, therefore, is if you enter into a compromise agreement, if the solicitor enters into a compromise agreement with the client, does that oust the jurisdiction of the court? And does it therefore circumvent those public policy issues? Now, interestingly, in this case, the court found not. And there are particular factual reasons why that was the case, largely arising from the fact that the person who'd entered into the contract was not the companies, but a third party, the individual who was the controller of those companies. But in different cases, there may be different answers.
There's a public policy interest, of course, as well, in the finality of litigation and parties reaching compromises and not having disputes dragged out through multi-stages, that can be avoided. Does that feature in the analysis?
Well, I think that features in the analysis under the Solicitors Act. And so if you claim an assessment of solicitors' fees under the Solicitors Act, you've got to do it quickly. And if you don't do it quickly, the court retains the discretion to allow you to do it after the event, but it's pretty tightly regulated. So, yes, that's absolutely right. And you're right to say, of course, that there is a powerful public policy issue in terms of the encouragement of compromise. But I think in this arena, there are clashing public policy issues. It's not just about facilitating compromise agreement. It's not just about holding people to their bargains. Rather, it's also about ensuring that the court has oversight over the administration of justice. But it's fair to say that the circumstances in which the courts will step in and interfere with these things are pretty narrow.
So, Simon, what are the takeaways for those listening?
Well, I think that the important lesson is that if you're going to enter into one of these agreements, think about it carefully and think about two things. First of all, who you're entering into the agreement with, because that may have an impact on whether or not the provisions in the Solicitors Act apply at all. But perhaps most importantly, just think about the terms of the deal, because in many cases, the court will retain a discretion to look at the agreement and may even set it aside in circumstances where it feels that it's not fair and reasonable.
Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations again to our new Silks, and indeed to everybody who has taken Silk in the past round. That was Judy Stone, Simon Forshaw, and Amy Rogers. By the time you're listening to this, KC. talking to me, Ruth Kennedy, about a recent case that each of them worked on as a senior junior. The podcast is produced by our own Hannah Slarks. You can find the 11KBW Employment Podcast on all usual podcast apps. You can also email us at employmentpodcast@11kbw.com.